This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. You can access shows live or as podcasts by going online to KUCI.org. This is the In the Garden Show, produced by the UC Master Gardeners of Orange County, California. I'm DC Morgan, your host this morning for the hour, and this week's topic is fungi or mushrooms. Our guest today is Joanne Swartz, who is a naturalist, and I'll let her tell her a little bit about her background and her titles. Welcome, Joanne.
Thank you, DC. I really do enjoy studying everything in nature, but my great passion is mushrooms, and has always been mushrooms. And so I'm an amateur mycologist, M-Y-C-O, the Greek word for mushroom.
Great.
I began studying these in 1965 because of an article in National Geographic.
Amazing what that magazine did for people. That's great. And what was your next step after that, after you read the article in the National Geographic?
Just awareness. Everywhere I looked, there were fungi. They hadn't been there the day before, but once I started looking, they were there.
Once you're aware, you see them everywhere, I
guess. Absolutely.
I saw your presentation to the Master Gardeners General Meeting, and it opened up a whole new world for me, or should I say kingdom, because they're their own kingdom, correct?
Absolutely. Plants, animals, fungi, and then a couple kingdoms of little bitty things.
How many, just in Orange County, I was amazed that they're more the macro ones that we see.
There's about 800 that have been well documented throughout California. But there's in California, we expect there's about 3,000 in California, about 6,000 in the United States. And right here in our county, there's probably about 1,500. Compare that with only 600 birds in California and 1,100 in the United States. This is a very big kingdom.
Very, very much unknown, too, to most people. Now, one definition I found of fungi is any of a group of spore-producing organisms feeding on organic matter, including molds, yeast, mushrooms, and toadstools, which is kind of a fanciful name for mushrooms. Would you agree with that?
I think that's really right. There's probably 1.5 million fungal species. But as you say, with rusts and molds and yeasts, we don't know much about those. So I focus mostly on the large fungi, which brings up the good question of toadstools that you mentioned.
Yes.
A toad sitting on a mushroom is the best definition of a toadstool. Toad is really Old English German for death.
Oh.
And toads were considered venomous beasts associated with witchcraft.
Ooh.
And since some fungi killed people,
Toadstools
were really places for toads to sit, but it became a common name for deadly mushrooms.
Yes, when I was researching, I saw something about witchcraft, but I didn't go into that. But, oh my goodness, it really got a bad rap.
Very bad rap. But some of them are deadly, so maybe not so undeserved.
Yeah. See, we talked about the numbers. Oh, I want to mention that we're sitting here and Joanne prepared a lovely cup of shiitake mushroom tea for us. So we're sipping on that. It's a cold day and we're sipping on that, and we hope to reap the benefits, the health benefits from it.
And we get to nibble the mushroom bits after we drink the tea.
Yeah, this is great. A new experience for me. Okay, I was curious to know what nutrients are in mushrooms, speaking of our tea, through the ones that we would normally eat, and which ones are the most nutritious?
Well, that's a long, complicated story, but we'll do part of it. Vitamins A, C, and D are very common. 5 different B-complex vitamins, very common.
Oh.
Minerals like calcium, phosphorus, iron, copper, potassium, manganese, and then odd things like folic acid, selenium, nucleic acid, amino acids, and fiber.
Wow, that comes a long way from what it used to be. People just thought they had vitamin E or something in them. But they've always been in salads, so you just keep eating them, and that's wonderful to hear that they have all those things in them.
Some have more protein than any other edible plant or vegetable, except nuts.
Oh, my goodness.
Like 40% of their dried weight in pure protein.
What ones are those? Would we see those in a market?
Yeah, the everyday little store-bought button mushroom is 37% when it's dried.
Oh, dried.
Dried weight of protein, and about 9% wet weight of protein. Good luck finding that in other plant or vegetable, plant or vegetable type foods.
Right. Compared to nuts, that's pretty amazing.
Some have more potassium than a banana by weight. Mm. We think eat a banana for potassium or antioxidant selenium than any other fruit or vegetable.
Wow, but you would have to eat a lot of them.
Well, per weight.
Yeah. So depending.
So a pound of beans versus a pound of mushrooms, or an ounce of beans or an ounce of mushrooms, just per weight, however much you eat.
Okay. Does cooking deplete the nutrients?
That's a really good question. Raw mushrooms are very hard to digest because the cell walls are made of chitin, which is similar to the stuff of crab shells, as opposed to cellulose that we can easily digest the plants are made out of.
Mm-hmm.
So, in fact, raw mushrooms are hard to digest. By thoroughly cooking them, you can have access to the nutrients that are locked up in those cells.
Okay.
So tossing them wet on a salad, just as a fresh mushroom, very little benefit except maybe the taste if you like it.
And the fiber.
But cook them and you get the nutrients out.
Okay. Wow. That's one of the good cooked vegetables or things that we eat. Which ones do you think are the most flavorful in a good way?
Well, some are very strong and nasty tasting, certainly. My husband and I each have different taste preferences, so it's really difficult to describe any answer for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
There are common groups of fungi, genera, genus, that most people love and which are commercially available and always found dried and sometimes fresh. Most available locally, fresh and dried, are button mushrooms. Dried is porcini mushrooms. I'd rate both of those about 8 on a 10 scale.
Mm.
The shiitake that we have in our tea is highly available everywhere, fresh and dried, even in the local markets, and are very tasty for most folks. I'd rate them a 9, but that's my personal taste. And morels and trumpets, you usually get only dried, unless you're up in Northern California, or pay an arm and a leg when they're at the local stores.
Oh, yes.
And I'd rate both of those a 10.
Ooh, okay.
There's another one that's common right now in the winter in our stores, and that's oyster mushrooms. I enjoy them, but I only rate them a 3 as they're really bland. But for someone who doesn't like shiitake because they're too strong, maybe they should stick with oyster mushrooms, and they'll like them.
Yeah. Yeah, it just goes, like you said, to individual taste.
Yes.
And then sometimes what you add in, butter, garlic, and so on.
Well, they're also very low calorie.
Oh, yes.
Until you add butter and garlic, thank you.
Yes. That's
or butter and sour cream and cream cheese. And
cream, yeah.
Oh, yum. Mm.
Now, I heard you talking about when you go out in the field and you're finding mushrooms, that you'll break off a little piece and taste it, but then you spit it out because you don't know at that point whether it's poisonous or not. So tell us about that.
Right. There's no mushroom in all of North America that's so toxic that you can't chew a bit of it raw and spit it out.
Oh.
It won't hurt you at all. There's
so
none that are that toxic. But and there's no need to rinse your mouth afterwards unless you just don't like the taste. Some of them are a little bitter.
Oh.
But this is a standard field test, as smelling mushrooms collected for science or for the table is a good standard field test. Some smell like almond extract. Tastes like that too. Radish, cinnamon, or really nasty chemicals. So it's helpful if you're finding them for science or just finding them for the table.
Yes. Yeah. Now, I think it's important to know that if someone did eat a poisonous mushroom, that it takes up to 7 days to affect the person. It can take up to 7 days. Tell us that story about that fellow that said, I gave my wife some mushrooms and left her this morning and she was fine.
Well, some of the mushrooms that are toxic And there's 8 different kinds of toxins, so they affect all different systems.
Oh, okay.
And just like with plants, there's lots of different types of toxins. Some of them, if you eat them within a half hour or 20 minutes, you'll get a very bad stomach upset, a GI upset. You might even lose your lunch. That's not so nice. But then it's over with, and that's not very toxic. Others could take 7 to 10 days before you die in a hospital from liver failure, kidney failure.
So sad.
Others affect your heart. It's complicated, just like plants.
That's for sure.
With that one fellow locally, I think you don't want to test it on a loved one. And if they don't die within a few hours, then it's okay for you to eat a great quantity of something.
Oh, no.
Not a good idea.
Okay. Is there a visual way to tell if a mushroom is poisonous to eat?
Not at all. They're all beautiful. They're all weird. They're all ugly. Whatever. That's your personal perception. But you can't tell by looking at a tomato plant that you can eat the tomato, but you can't eat the green leaves, which are really toxic.
Mm-hmm.
And just like you can't tell that, you can't tell by looking at a fungi. There's a lot of wonderful folk wisdom over the millennia of what you can and can't eat. Some of my favorite that are all foolish, all of these are wrong, don't believe any of these, are if a quarter or garlic turns black or an onion turns blue when cooking, the mushrooms are poisonous. Now, these are all ones that I've heard local people here in Orange County tell me. Fungi are toxic if they taste bitter or ooze milky fluid or if the flesh turns blue when broken. No, some of those are good. Safe kinds are easily peeled. No. Dried fungi are all okay to eat because they lose their toxins when they're dry. That's really stupid. If animals eat fungi, they must be safe. I saw a deer eating this certain mushroom. It must be safe. No, slugs and deer don't have the same digestive system and chemistry that we have in our body. All of this is bad advice. I've collected about 30 of these bits of bad wisdom.
Yeah.
You can't tell just by looking any more than my example of a tomato and the tomato vine.
That was really good because I know most all our gardeners love, that's one of the favorite things they grow in their garden is tomatoes.
But nobody eats tomato leaves.
No.
And you better not.
Yeah. Listen up, people. Okay, you mentioned 2 cookbooks on your flyer from the meeting when we saw you a while back. And one of them is Joe's Book of Mushrooms Cookery by Jack Czarnecki. It was originally written in 1986 published in 86, but it's since been updated. And the other one is The Joy of Truffles, also back a few years back, 1998. Have you tried some or many of these recipes, and do you have any favorites to share?
Well, first I'd like to add one more cookbook that's more recent. A fellow named Chad Hyatt wrote The Mushroom Hunter's Kitchen. And that's also really excellent. All 3 of those are fabulous. Now, I rarely use recipes when cooking, and I cook a tremendous amount, but I don't use recipes very often, except perhaps in baking a new bread recipe the first time, because baking is very sensitive to your mixture of chemicals and ingredients. But I do use recipes to learn what herbs and spices and flavors go with which fungi. What each one tastes like, which one works well in soups, not to be too gelatinous maybe. That's how I use cookbooks generally. A couple things people can do readily is make mushroom ketchup, basically a thick sauce with a strong umami flavor like a steak sauce or soy sauce that you can add on a lot of things like you do steak sauce and soy sauce. Make mushroom soup. Obviously, you don't have to add cream and a lot of butter. It doesn't have to be high calorie like the old-fashioned cream of mushroom soup. You can make a really hearty spread for toast. Sauté some mushrooms and onions together and maybe some herbs from the garden.
I could have that just for dinner.
Spread it on toast. Yummy.
Yes. Like avocado toast, but mushroom toast.
And it's like avocado toast. Same idea. And then, of course, pasta sauces. But first, I suggest strongly that you start out with a new mushroom, just sautéing it in a little extra virgin olive oil and or a little butter. Really plain, not too much oil, and perhaps add just a titch of salt. so that you can really taste the mushroom.
Yeah, the salt really brings out the flavor.
Oh, it brings out the flavor, as with any, with many foods. But it, you don't want it too complicated if you're trying a new mushroom, even if you just buy it from your local market.
Right. And it's a good idea to mix a little olive oil and butter. That's how the French do it, and there's always...
Is that how the French do it? I've never been to France.
Because the oil keeps the butter from burning, yet you get the buttery flavor.
Yes. Yeah. Wonderful idea.
Yeah. Let's see here. Now, some of the common ones I've seen in our Orange County grocery stores are the button little white mushroom and the large and small cremini. And what other ones do you think would be great to look for in our local markets?
Well, first, just a comment about the button mushrooms and these big portobellos that are 4, 5, 6, 7 inches across even.
That's the other one, yeah.
The portobellos, the cremini, and the white little button mushrooms are all the same species. Imagine marketing for $7 or $8 a pound the big portobellos just because they got big and old and opened up. Whereas most people go to the store and just select the closed little tight buttons, and if it started opening the littlest bit, they'll throw it to the side. Well, it's like eating green bananas. If you want to have the flavor, the mushroom needs to mature, to open up, to drop its spores so the gills turn brown, not white. Those little store mushrooms, anyway. Yeah. And those are good for grilling, grilling or sautéing or making sauces out of, doesn't matter. But let them open up. I put them on my counter in a bag, and in a brown paper bag, and let them just open on their own. There's a problem recently, though, and that is the commercial growers have been cold, almost freezing the fungi for a long time in the distribution system. And once they've been held too cold for too long, they'll never open. So they're okay. If you can get ones like the big portobellos that have opened all the way and are even starting to dry out a little bit. Number one, you get a lot more mushrooms for the dollar, but better than that. They are the richest tasting. They're as good as the steak ever was.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah. And it is the opposite of the little white ones. You don't want them to be open underneath, right?
Yeah, you want them. They're the
same
species.
Okay.
You want them open up, so... Buy them, take them home, put them in a bag, a brown paper bag on your counter for 2 days. If they open, that's great. If not, they're okay.
But they're more flavorful.
Much more flavorful.
Oh.
Do a taste test in your own house, and you'll never go back to closed up little buttons again.
That is really good information to have. Okay, where were we? Okay.
All those other ones I mentioned a few minutes ago, like trumpets and chanterelles and shiitake, might be in the local stores for a few weeks at a time. They'll be at the local farmers markets. Either wild harvested or commercially grown. So there's a wide range you can try. Find out which ones you like.
So I'll be looking for mushrooms next time I hit the farmer's market.
Good idea.
Yeah. Now, what ones would be good to grow in our local gardens here in OC? And if they grow by spores, not seeds, where can we find them for purchase?
Growing is really tricky, hard to say. A tomato plant, you get a couple seeds, you let them overwinter, you grow them in little sprouts, and all of a sudden you've got a tomato bush that harvests 100 pounds of tomatoes. And that's just wonderful. Fungi aren't that way. Most of the tastiest ones grow in association with trees, mostly pines and oaks. So it's very hard to get those to grow in your garden because you can't get the association going. That's why there's only a few species. Say of the 800 well-known ones in California, there's probably 6 or 10 that you can ever buy in the markets. Very hard to grow them. It's a very sterile process. It's a very fussy process. So for home growers who can't control humidity, temperature, CO2 concentrations, really fine-tuning soil substrates, and exactly varying these precisely during the about a month of growing cycle, you can't grow them at home.
So you basically have to be a scientist to grow them.
Or a commercial grower who can control, put oxygen in the tent for a while, then put CO2 in the tent, and then suck it all out and raise the temperature for 3 days and that kind of thing.
I'll have a greater appreciation next time I buy my mushrooms.
But on the other hand, if I find mushrooms wild or even the store-bought mushrooms that have gone bad maybe, gotten soggy, that are just decomposers, that just grow in grass or in humus soil. When I'm done with them, I'll take all the spare parts that have some spores on them and throw them out in my backyard, under bushes, under trees, just all around. And sometimes in 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, they'll actually grow. That mycelium underground will grow,
yes.
And it'll decide to fruit a mushroom at some point in the future. So right now I've got some agaricus related to the store mushroom, the little button mushroom,
okay.
Growing in the backyard. They might be the result of something we tossed out there at one point.
That's fun. Wow.
You asked how you can get the spores or the mycelium.
Yeah.
So I looked online the other day, and I found places in Lithuania and Ukraine where you could very cheaply buy mushroom seeds, they call it, on the web. It's spores, but it's your responsibility to get them into the country.
Oh.
And that's impossible.
Yes.
Ridiculous.
Yeah.
But you can buy a whole mushroom kit, a mushroom log, from a place in California like Far West Fungi. And they're up in San Francisco and in Santa Cruz. And they'll sell you a little kit. And you just keep that kit warm. It's some substrate, which could be a combination of coffee, wood chips, newspaper, just cellulose stuff. But they've inoculated it with the mushroom spores, and it's grown mycelium, and it'll fruit some mushrooms right on your kitchen counter. The mushrooms come out that way at about $20 a pound, but it sure is fun.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, cute Christmas present for somebody.
That would be a cute Christmas present for somebody. Yeah, I don't recommend anyone try this at home unless they have a lot of time and patience and all that needs to go with it.
It's like starting an orchid from seeds.
Mm.
That's a tricky process that a lot of master gardeners have read about, and I bet very few work with orchid seeds.
Yeah.
Very hard.
And they say the same with poinsettias.
Oh, yes.
We were told don't bother to keep it. Just buy new ones every year because it's such a process to raise them.
Yes.
Now, a friend of mine was telling me about a place in Escondido where they grow mushrooms, and then people can go there and get mushroom mulch for their gardens. What do you think about that? Is it worth the trip?
Oh, yeah. I think that would be a great idea. I know friends who do that up in Ventura and up in Santa Cruz area, and it's great mulch. Now, if you have access to a coffee roaster and can get coffee grounds or the husks of coffee during the roasting process, if you have access to a beer brewery, you can get the spent grain, etc. There's lots of commercial processes where you can get the resulting throwaway organic material to add to your compost pile or however you process it in your yard. The mushroom mulch would be a fine thing, too. Most of these are free. You can get all the spent grain you want at a brewery, and you can get all the coffee grounds you want at a roaster.
Oh,
so I don't know what they charge in Escondido. But if it's pretty free, you can go down there and help yourself. I can be great for the garden. Bring me some next time you get some.
Yeah, he said it was free. And
great.
He also said they use the waste from the horses that run at Del Mar. And I thought, well, those horses are fed really well, so it's probably very good stuff.
Yeah, great idea. A lot of free mulch for the garden.
Good. I found it interesting when you were speaking that mushrooms have no chlorophyll, which is why they are usually white or beige or brown with no green. They don't process the light like other plants. Like plants, they're a fungi, they're not a plant.
Mm-hmm.
And that light is not essential, so you can find them growing under logs and other dark places where plants cannot grow. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. That's a good and complicated question. First of all, the fungi, yes, don't like chlorophyll. And they relate to plants. They make these mycorrhizal associations, many of them, with plants that do make chlorophyll. The mushroom gives the nutrients to the plant and the water to the plant and gets the carbohydrates back from the plant, from a tree, for example. But mushrooms do come in red, blue, purple, green, orange, a wide range of colors. They don't need chlorophyll to come in colors.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one good thing to straighten out.
Yeah, they do have some color on the orange-yellow side. Yeah. Yeah, that was my next...
That's separate from chlorophyll.
Yeah. And I know that mycorrhizae fungi is very important to have in the soil for growing plants and trees. You touched on it a bit, but can you expand on the benefits to each?
Sure. First thing is to think of what is a mushroom. A mushroom is the fruit of a big fungus. Just like on my tangerine tree, the little tangerine that you pick is simply the fruit of this big thing that's called a tree that has roots in the ground and leaves on top. So a mushroom isn't just this little cute thing you pick out of the ground that grows. It's the mycelium, this network that grows underground. And it could be 2 miles wide. It could be hundreds of feet wide. So like right now I've got a certain group of mushrooms fruiting in the backyard. It's probably all one mycelium. So that's, first of all, interesting. Picking the mushroom is no different than picking the tangerine. Doesn't hurt the fungus at all.
Oh, good.
So you can pick all the little mushrooms you want, like picking tangerines. When you pick the tangerine, you don't rip the whole branch off the tree. Nor when you do a mushroom, do you dig with a shovel and hurt that mycelium. You gently either dig a little bit of it up if you're studying it to identify it, perhaps, or cut it off if you want to eat it. Don't hurt that mycelium. If you dig a hole, replace the divot to keep that mycelium nice.
Yeah, it's part of the living network underground. We want that. So that must be what the big commercial growers do, too. They just take the fruit and leave the rest in the soil.
Well, the commercial pickers should do that, go into the forest and pick wild-growing mushrooms. But some of them get very aggressive with rakes and such and really destroy the area of the forest for 10, 15 years. Then they have to go to a new area. Commercial growers don't tend to grow the mycorrhizal ones, meaning the ones that associate with trees and plants. Okay. They tend to grow the decomposing ones that grow in coffee grounds or in newspapers or just simple organic material, your compost pile, or in my lawn.
Okay, yeah.
And therefore, then you don't have to really worry too much about that mycelium because it's not hooking to the trees and it's not as extensive.
Yeah, so I know the first time I saw it in my backyard, I went, ew, I kind of freaked out. Yeah.
It's beautiful. But it'll either be white or yellow, mostly white. And in every garden, if you dig in the soil, you'll see cottony mycelium around the hole where you're going to plant your new plant. And if you're in the woods, every time you lift up a piece of bark or oak bark I've got falling off a tree in the backyard, there's mycelium under that, a white cottony network.
Yes.
That's beautiful.
It is beautiful.
Art.
Yeah.
And, and it's nature.
It's living. And it's benefiting all the things that are growing around it, the trees and the plants that are growing around it. So don't get freaked out and just leave it alone. Don't disturb it. And the life all around it will flourish. Okay, it's time to take a quick station identification. So I just want everyone to know that this is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, and the opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. We are talking today about fungi, mushrooms, for the common word, of the ones that we normally see in the market and in our yards. And we're here with Joanne Schwartz, who is a naturalist and an amateur mycologist. And she is just full of great information on this subject that not many people study. So tell us about the shapes and parts of the mushroom. We haven't covered that yet.
Well, most people go out and look for mushrooms. Why they miss most is because they're only looking for something that looks like a little button mushroom. And while that exists, and you'll find those in your garden or in the forest, there's lots of other shapes. There's big balls that can be 2 feet across that break up and give their spores up to the air. There's jelly fungi. There's cups. There's ones that look like coral. There's ones that look like brains. There's ones that look like little shelves coming off a tree. Many, and there's a whole bunch more shapes, many more shapes. So you've got to go, I suggest going on, if nothing else, just Google search for images of fungi and just see the range of what you're even looking for. And then you'll say, oh my, that's a mushroom, that's a mushroom, that's a mushroom.
Yeah, we're just looking at one of her books, the beautiful pictures, the orange that's like coral. One that looks like just a big gray beige ball. One that almost looks like a pancake coming off a tree in layers. And some that look like they were made in Disneyland. And the toadstools. And yeah, it's such a range of colors and shapes and sizes. That is really a good thing to bring up. Some of the things that stuck with me were when you were talking about the cordyceps that invade insects' bodies, something like a beetle they would invade.
Yes.
And then they use them to disperse spores from the trees. The beetle crawls up the tree and he takes over the body of the beetle, I guess. But tell us about that. You're dead.
Well, imagine a little mushroom that's going to be only an eighth of an inch to a quarter of an inch high. If it grew on the ground, it would have a hard time getting its spores to disperse very far away to start new mushrooms. So some of the fungi are parasitic and land on an insect, and it could be an ant or a beetle or any of many insects, and change the brain of that insect. So the ground-dwelling ant now is told for the first time in his life, as the mushroom's growing, the mycelium's growing in the body of the ant, to go up the tree. And to go out to the farthest limb, and to go out to the farthest leaf, and bite on that farthest off leaf, and die, as the mushrooms are growing a quarter of an inch high and dispersing their spores from 40 feet high.
That is
the first time I saw that. It sounded odd, but yeah. That happens right here in Orange County.
Oh my goodness! Yeah, it does sound like science fiction.
Yes, it does.
The body invaders or snatchers or whatever. Let's see, this is where it would be nice to have a photo to show them.
Oh, I wish we could. But yeah. The word is cordyceps, C-O-R-D-Y-C-E-P.
Okay.
Search for it, see pictures of it, you'll be blown away at the pictures. It is better than science fiction.
Right, show your kids. This is real life. Also, the stonewashed jeans. You said that they were... Well, there's a whole history behind that, and we don't know the timeline on it, but it was really interesting. If you want to tell
it surely is. We started making jeans sometime in the middle of the 1900s, as we know them today. By the 60s, there was a cool look that came that was stonewashed jeans. They actually imported pumice to this country from Europe. I have no idea why we just didn't go out to the pumice fields in California and get pumice.
Yeah.
And toss the jeans around, washed them with the stones of pumice, which is very abrasive, and it made the jeans look already worn. Cool look, they thought.
Yes.
But the pumice bits got stuck in the machinery and destroyed machines because it's a very hard little rock. So they used instead enzymes to break down the cotton in jeans. Turned out that was pretty expensive until someone found a couple species of fungi that work for a third of the price, as I understand, that the enzymes cost and weren't harmful to the environment to get rid of afterwards.
What a great benefit.
And we have stonewashed jeans. They're still doing that today.
There you go. Okay, and then one of the really beneficial species is, you were talking about the oyster fungi, which can decompose oil from oil spills, and it can do it in as little as 6 months?
Well, and maybe even less. We were down in Ecuador, and there's one of the major worldwide oil companies that's exploring in the rainforest and discarding an awful lot of used oil resulting from their drilling operations, just letting it flow out into the rainforest, which is horrible.
Yeah.
And horrible ecologically, maybe efficient for them. But we found that the oyster mushroom, a standard mushroom you can go to your local market and buy, and it's sort of, I think, it's certainly edible. People like it. Doesn't taste too strong, so it's not my favorite. That if they grow the mycelium from the oyster mushroom, truck it down to Ecuador, now they're growing it down there, they can put it in these oil cesspools in the jungle, and it starts right away growing fantastically. That mycelium has never grown faster and eats up the oil. And within 6 months to a year, depending on how deep the oil pool is and all, and what the substrate, the plant and the soil substrate is, they can totally remediate the oil spill. I think it's pretty amazing.
It is the way everything has a purpose. You know, you think, oh, it's just a mushroom, but everything has a great purpose on this earth.
Well, oil is something that some mushrooms can't eat very well, and some that are easy to grow could be used. If people want to learn more, look, just search for a TED Talk on YouTube by Paul Stamets, S-T-A-M-E-T-S. He's done probably 4 or 5 or 6 that deal with this eco-remediation of oil spills with fungi and some other interesting topics.
Did he do anything on bees?
Yes. He's studying with University of Washington, or through University of Washington, using some fungus to stop the process, some of the process that's causing the collapse of bee colonies now.
Yeah.
And he has a couple TED Talks that address that, and it's also fascinating. I haven't been involved in that research.
That's a hot topic, though. Yeah.
Yes, it is.
Kind of ties in. Okay. Do you know if they used any mushrooms for that Gulf of Mexico spill that we had back in 2010?
I know that there were at least 2 groups who tried to, but they didn't get enough funding, and they were stopped politically in the process. So we didn't get, as I understand, we didn't get very far with that, either as research or as really remediating that oil spill.
Yeah. And maybe the salt water, too, wouldn't work with
it. It's happened before in salt water.
Oh,
they have
gosh.
Used it before in salt water.
Wow.
Up in Alaska and other places.
Wonderful.
But,
okay.
You know, there's got to be money to do an industrial process like that.
Yeah. Okay, another true story you told us about was the caribou up north of the Arctic Circle.
Yes.
And they eat the Amanita muscaria mushroom, which is poisonous to humans, but the caribou can eat it. And then what did the shaman find out?
Well, the shamans like to have vision quests, altered states of consciousness to determine whatever they need to about their people and the world around them. And the Amanita muscaria has psychoactive properties. Trick is, it's also really toxic. But the caribou's digestive system, being very different than ours, strains out the other toxins other than the psychoactive compounds. So if one drinks the caribou urine, one can have the psychoactive experiences. Good things for shamans.
Yeah.
But even the more interesting part is that the next in line shaman down the way can drink the shaman's urine and still get some of the psychoactive properties.
My goodness, what man goes to do these things, the spiritual rituals.
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. Then there was the fact that fungi can get going and even break up stone floors or cement floors in churches or on roads. As it grows and expands, it can crack it.
There is one here in Orange County. I'm sure that happens with a number of them, but there's one here in Orange County, down in Sky Park Circle area, breaks up the asphalt all the time. And we had a business down there for a while, and we bring that to the attention of the maintenance people. And did they laugh at me? I don't even think they believed what I was saying. And they certainly didn't believe what they saw. What's really happening is plants grow by adding cells. Like people grow by adding cells. Mushrooms don't generally do that. They grow by increasing the size of each cell. Mm. There's a tremendous amount of hydrostatic pressure in the cells to grow, to get longer, 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 since the mushroom to grow 10 inches high, 2 feet high, 6 inches high, doesn't add extra cells. And that pressure is very strong and, yes, can break cathedral floors or, locally, streets.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, so watch out for the fungi. Okay. Oh, one fun subject we have to be sure and cover are the fairy rings.
Yep, some mushrooms can be seen in large rings on lawns. Right near us here, a block away, there's a 30 or 40 foot across ring of dark green grass, and occasionally there'll be mushrooms in that big circle. We call them fairy rings. Now, how that happens is the mushrooms in the fairy ring appear when the fairies leave their shawls on the ground when heading into the bushes with their amorous partners after dancing the night before. So when you see these, you know that the fairies were there the night before. Oh. Actually, what happens is one or two mushrooms grow in a certain spot. They use up all the nutrients. That mycelium under the ground moves outward where there's new nutrients. And then fruits at some point, and six more mushrooms come up.
Pops up again.
And then they move out, and more mushrooms pop up farther and farther and farther from that center spot. Ah, we're forming a ring.
Yes.
More interesting is the mycelium actually enhances the nutrients in the grass, like in association with the trees. So the grass gets very green on the outside of the mushroom circle, making more nutrients for the next time the mushrooms fruit farther away from the center. The largest one we know about is a circle about 2,000 feet across. It's almost a half mile that's been observed in Europe for over 700 years.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, I was reading. I think it said it was in Belfort, France.
Yes.
Largest ever seen. It grew to 2,000 feet in diameter.
You got it.
And it's 700 years old. And that was, well, what I read was an article in Garden Collage magazine, but from 2017. But, yeah. And there's a Welsh folklore that says, grow your crops near and your livestock near those rings because it'll improve fertility and improve the crops.
Well, those fairies certainly have lots of skills and attributes, and certainly among them are beliefs.
Yes, yeah.
I have no idea if it'll make the cattle more fertile.
Yeah, but I wonder if it does help the crops with the mycorrhizae fungal networks.
If it happens to be a crop that just like the grass, gets greener at the outside of the circle.
Yeah.
Maybe some other crops also would be enhanced at the outside of that circle. It's probably a good idea.
Yeah.
With some fungi, that would probably work.
There's a really good new documentary out called Fantastic Fungi, and I think you went and saw it.
Yes. Schwartzberg and this fellow Paul Stamets that I mentioned got together and made this. And it is spectacular, I think. Everyone should see it. It's only being shown at odd places here and there where there's a local theater. And it's worth driving for, though. You can go on the Fantastic Fungi website and click on all the locations. And whether you're in Europe or here, you'll find a place that you can drive to. And it's a wonderful movie. It's a documentary.
How long is it? About an hour?
I would say about an hour and 20 minutes.
Okay. So almost the regular movie.
It's a serious movie.
Yeah.
It's a serious movie. And it will eventually be released on streaming services, perhaps, but certainly not for the next year, they told us.
Okay.
And if you're lucky, you'll get to see one of those, either Paul Stamets or Schwartzberg, at the movie and doing a talk afterwards. If you can go to one like that, like I did, it's especially fascinating.
Yes. Well, what else would you like to share with our audience?
Well, you know, I want to share a couple ways people can get involved with fungi. I think the first thing is to get a book if you want to learn more.
Mm-hmm.
One good idea is get a book. California Mushrooms is a relatively new guide, I think 2017 or 18. It's a big book, so you're not going to carry it in your hip pocket, but it's wonderful. I would start with that. Also, go online and learn of, you know, there's many, many websites to learn about fungi with. Come to other presentations, and I do a bunch here in Orange County. Other people do them online from around the world and learn that way. You can certainly get personally involved, though, by going out and looking. Look within a quarter of a mile of anyone's house at most times of year, you're going to find fungi. If you look for more than just those little button mushrooms, if you look for all those funny shapes that we talked about earlier. And a last thing you can do, if this is enticing and you really want to learn more, is an organization I'm dealing with that I'm on the board of as a nonprofit is the North American Mycoflora, M-Y-C-O, Flora Project at mycoflora.org. The idea there is to involve everybody as a citizen scientist studying mushrooms. Not only do you get to learn, but you get to contribute what you learn in several really important ways back to science. You get your own project. you learn to take good photographs of them and identify them a little bit, but you send in bits of them for DNA barcoding.
Oh, how cool.
Which really identifies what they are or determines that it's a new species that's not been identified, even though it looks like something in the book.
And then they can name it after you.
No, yeah, they can name it after you or after your favorite pet or whatever. And then you send the rest of it to an herbarium. Locally, we send them to the UCI herbarium. We call it a fungarium when it's devoted to fungi. But okay. There's a
And they
UCI
have a devoted
herbarium.
One there for fungi?
They are setting up a devoted fungarium.
Okay.
For just fungi. Anyway, it's citizen science at its best, and I encourage folks to get involved. One other fascinating area of mushrooms that people will be surprised at is to think about lichens. Well, moss is a plant. Lichens that either can grow on rock or on ground or on sides of trees are fungi. Well, they're really fungi doing agriculture. They're a combination of sometimes three different kingdoms. There's a plant in a mandatory association with a fungus, sometimes with a bacteria or a cyanobacteria. So three kingdoms together. They are now related, or they are now classified as fungi, because the fungus is the entity that controls the reproduction and the food gathering of this whole organism that we call lichens.
Huh.
And they're just as fascinating as what we call macrofungi that we've been talking about, that look like the button mushroom in the store. But lichens are fungi too.
Huh. Yeah, I always think of buildings in Europe with the one side will be covered in the lichen. I don't see it that much in Southern California, of course, because it's too warm probably.
But if you go under the oak trees, I was out this morning, and you go under the oak trees, there's lichen everywhere.
Yeah, the green side?
The green is sometimes moss, but sometimes lichen.
Okay.
So if you, again, learn what lichens look like, and you'll start seeing them everywhere.
That's what I'll have to do, yeah. Because I probably would have thought it was moss, but let's see. Some of the things I wanted to share with as references and resources for people were, we talked about that book, The California Mushroom. That's a really good one. And then there's Mushrooms of North America.
It's an older book. It's wonderful. And there's also Mushrooms of the Redwood Coast. It's a brand new book, but only covers Santa Cruz North.
Okay. All right. Well, I have friends in Santa Cruz, so I'll have to let them know.
Nice Christmas present.
Yeah.
A birthday present or whatever. Yeah.
And then you talked about background books, The Complete Mushroom Hunter by Gary Lenkoff.
Yes, it's excellent.
A Separate Kingdom by L. Parker and D.T. Jenkins. That's from 1979.
Yeah. But that's a book that has lots of these stories, like how did Santa Claus get his red and white outfit? From Amanita muscaria that's eaten by the caribou. A caribou is a reindeer. We complete some of the story of Santa Claus and his reindeer because of a red mushroom, a mushroom with generally a red cap with white dots on it.
Yeah.
So that book is all about the stories, very rich cultural stories of fungi.
Right. So that would be something different from the scientific
type. Yeah, not scientific at all.
Yeah. And then there's The Romance of the Fungus World.
Same kind of book.
Okay, good. And that's by Rowley and Rowley. It's and Dover took it over. I published it in 1974, but they may have new publishing since then, too. Okay, and we talked about the cookbooks, Joe's Book of Mushroom Cookery and The Joy of Truffles, both good ones.
And that one new one that I haven't added to the list yet.
Yeah. Do you want to mention that one again?
Yeah. It's The Mushroom Hunter's Kitchen by Chad Hyatt, H-Y-A-T-T, 2018.
Oh, that's really new. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then as far as organizations, there's the Los Angeles Mycological Society.
That has a wonderful mushroom fair every late January or early February up at the L.A. Arboretum, which is a one-day event that's great fun. They also conduct forays, meaning mushroom hunts, that only if you're a member you can go on. But everybody can go to the mushroom fair.
I'm gonna write that down and try to make it. Put it on my calendar. And then there's the North American Mycological Society. I think you mentioned that. Or
no, that's a different one. Okay. That's a general amateur club throughout the whole country.
Okay. And then the one you did mention was the North American Mycoflora Project.
Right. That's the group I'm very intimately involved with.
And that they've got a lot of stuff going on locally. Good.
And if people are in other areas like San Diego or Santa Cruz or San Francisco or Portland, Oregon, there's a mycological society for you.
Okay.
Just search it up and find some cool naturalists to go out with and learn about this fascinating kingdom.
Yes. And then some websites are the Natural History of Orange County. Go to the fungi page. And then the Mushroom Observer. It's an international mushroom ID with location.
Yes, it's sort of like iNaturalist that a lot of people know, but it's specifically for fungi. And so I put my records of new things that I find on Mushroom Observer, but if you want to go on there and see the distribution of a certain mushroom, you can certainly do that.
Yeah, and you can Google all these. And then lastly, there's an article by David Arora on edible California porcini species.
So there's a kind of mushroom that doesn't have gills like the little store-bought mushrooms, that instead has pores underneath. And those are generally called boletes. And his article is about porcini, which is an edible group of those in California. It's an old article, but it's excellent. It's fun to search for.
Well, there you have it. Boy, we packed a lot in this hour, and want to thank you so much. See if there's any last parting words you want to leave with our audience.
Well, you might look for field trips locally that are, for example, run by the California Native Plant Society or Rancho Mission Viejo Reserve.
Okay, yes. And these will be coming up in, usually they have them December through February.
That's our mushroom season here.
Yes. So go ahead and Google those. It'll be a fun little field trip for you and your family to learn about these wonderful kingdom of fungi. Thank you again, Joanne. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
It's so interesting.
It's fun thinking about fungi. It's nice to share it with you, DC.
Okay, tune in again next Thursday for In the Garden. Thank you.